I'm Bob Crawford.
And I'm Ben Sawyer.
And this is The Road to Now. Ben, this is our first podcast. We've talked about doing this for 5 years.
Right.
And finally, today, we start our history podcast.
That's right. And we met years ago. And I remember we met through Scott and Seth and Dane, who I grew up with those guys back in Cabarrus County, North Carolina. We met and we discovered that we have this shared love of history, which we would spend hours discussing whenever I ran into these guys. And Bob and I became friends through this, and we would just make each other excited about talking about history. And now this opportunity to share it, you know, when we talked about doing it, you know, I remember when I first started speaking to Bob, I was living in Michigan in graduate school at Michigan State. He was, they played a venue in Detroit where 125 people showed up. And I was like, how could the world get any better than this? And then now I'm actually a full-time teacher at Middle Tennessee State University, yeah. And Bob is a rock star. Yeah. So
Ben's a historian, and I play bass. So what we're going to do is we're going to bring in some great guests over the weeks, and we're going to talk about how we got to where we are today on particular historical issues. So we hope that you will join us on this journey. Our first episode coming up right now is about new populism.
Right, and I think one of the things that's going to set us apart is that we genuinely are led by questions. How did we get to here? And we will ask those questions and pursue them on our own. We will ask those questions of academics, of politicians, of really anyone whose stories can help illuminate really just this path between the present and the past. And I think the great thing about this is going to be finding those links that we don't always find. I think academic historians sometimes are isolated from the public and vice versa. And this is a really great opportunity to do what I see as a service and something that I love and am passionate about.
Without further ado, The Road to Now. Yes. You know, we are definitely at a entering a new era. And that what that era truly is hasn't been defined yet. But when I first I always loved history growing up as a child. I was always drawn to going to historic sites or, history-based television shows,
right,
or history classes in grade school and high school. But I can remember distinctly, it was the summer of 2004. We were still reeling from the aftermath of 9/11.
Right.
The war in Iraq was not going well at all. Abu Ghraib was in the headlines.
Yeah.
2004 election campaign was in full swing. And I wondered how it was that we got from that founding generation to 2004. So I began to read as many history books as I could get my hands on and devour. And at the outset, I expected what I would find was a straight line.
Yeah.
You know, a straight line from the revolution of cause and effect that brought us to 9/11, the war in Iraq, and everything that was kind of going on at that point. And as I began to read, I realized that history is not a straight line.
Oh my God, no, it's not.
American history is very—it's very convoluted, and there's like a lot. We call this the road to now. Well, that road has a lot of byways, highways, on ramps, off ramps, bridges, detours. You know,
roundabouts that we get stuck in.
Right, and so, you know, I think it's just really important for all Americans, particularly at this time, to devote a little time to the study of the history of our nation. And a lot of people, there are parts of our history, of our collective American history, that we're embarrassed by,
right,
or we're ashamed by, or we are different. People argue over, was it a good history? Is that history being told properly? Is it being told honestly? Something that I found studying history is all the great characters you find in fiction exist in real life in American history. There's heroic people, there are scoundrels, there are bad men who try to redeem themselves, there are good men who go bad. I like to say there's the good, the bad, and the ugly of American history.
Right.
We don't have to love it all, but I think we need to embrace it, and we need to accept even the parts that we're ashamed of or embarrassed about or we don't really understand.
I agree. And as an educator, that's something that's important to me. Because if you really want to understand the past, and especially in a democracy, we understand that all people have good and bad in them. But then the problem is that people want to tell a story in which we're only our nation's only good. But if we accept that a democracy is made up of people and people have good and bad intentions, then we can be good and both bad. We have that potential. Accepting that is something that's important because we have to really reflect upon our nation's past if we're going to get to where we actually want to be. And one of the things that, you know, I faced in my life, you know, talking about this stuff as a college educator, I always tell my students, when I go up there, I'm honest with them on the first day. I say, you're at a university. You're going to learn things you've never heard before because the stories you hear prior to this in our education system, for the most part, they're crafted by politicians. And the questions that a lot of Americans want to ask is not necessarily what happened, but what would I like to have happened? Right. And they go back and they paste over what they would ideally have had happened upon what actually is in the past. And for people, sometimes when I bring this up, I tell them I'm honest. And I've heard people in the past say to me, you know, if you don't like this country, then leave, simply because I've brought up, you know, the problems of the past, such as slavery or, you know, or conquest of other countries' lands. That's not how it works in my mind. In my mind, if you love something, you don't walk away from it. Right, you stick with it. That's what love is. So I'm not leaving because I do love my country. And I want to tell this story because ultimately whatever happened in the past, we're here. We just have to grapple with the bad part of history, which we're not proud of, so that we can come to terms with who we are and chart a course that's better for us.
You know, I think that leads us to what we agreed on would be the topic of this first show,
right?
Which is populism.
Yes.
And more specifically, new populism. And I don't know if that's a coined term yet, but I feel like we're in an era of new populism. When we agreed to that this would be the topic we would focus on, we started to kind of throw around the history of American populism, right? Which I think most people would could, when you do your research, you see that period of the late 19th century,
yeah,
the agrarian uprising, and that was a movement by farmers,
right,
to make politics work for them. New technologies were coming around.
Yes.
The world was changing. They it was no longer really feasible to be a family farmer at that time and to be able to rent the land.
Or to be able to own your own land, essentially, and be self-sustaining in the Jeffersonian ideal. So the problem is that people were, I think, you know, and speaking about populism and trying to draw lines between history, one of the first things that I started out doing when you talked about doing this was trying to find parallels between the populist movement you're talking about in the late 19th century and today because of the terminology. And even as a professional historian, sometimes I'm sitting there, you know, trying to make these lines. And in fact, I don't know that they exist. I think they're clearly lines to other parts of history. But the one thing I think that, you know, that this period now has in common with, you know, and what we're talking about with the new populism has something in common with the late 19th century is the fact that people are realizing that the ideology, in other words, you know, at that time in the 19th century, the right to own one's land and determine one's future and everything, that was increasingly in conflict with the reality of the world. And so they were trying to hold on to an ideal that didn't fit anymore. That, to me, is what I see now as you know, as people who have been told their whole lives, go to college, you'll be fine if you do that, if you just work hard. People are now grappling with the fact that that's not a reality like it used to be, even though most generations who live beyond, you know, the younger folks, they still believe it. And so that's the conflict between those two, the real and the ideal, is coming to really to be a problem now as it was then. Other than that, I think the lines are very, very, very wavy that lead us from that movement to the modern one.
So what are the events that we've seen over the past decade that have kind of, because I suspect that this began, this trend of we don't do as well as our parents before us did.
Right.
This didn't just start for the 2016 campaign.
No.
This didn't start in 2010 when the Tea Party first gained its strength. This started long before that. When did this start?
I mean, if you start looking, you know, The post-World War II expansion really, really shapes our modern world in terms of how we understand our place and our opportunities. But I think for blue-collar workers, the realization that things weren't getting better came much earlier. And I think it came, you know, you can see in the 1970s even, you know, the sense of decline, you know, with Carter and things like this. But I think the difference now, you know, is that the movement, the populist movement, the voice of discontent, it's now joined with the middle class. And the middle class have access. They have access and they have a sense of empowerment, and a lot of them have an education that teaches them the, you know, how to access power and have a voice. So you already have large numbers of blue-collar folks who have kind of felt pushed aside. Now they're joined with people who feel empowered, feel like they have a right to speak, and understand the mechanisms to get access to the media and to our attention. And those two things merge, and suddenly it seems to come out of nowhere. But I think this is probably just you know, a greater movement of blue-collar workers feeling, you know, disenfranchised or not able to participate, being joined now by a voice with a new group of folks who have access.
It's funny, part of the research that we looked at to do this episode was a historian's roundtable, and the subject was populism, and the year was 2008. And
you
start reading this thing, and they're saying, well, populism is no longer a popular area of study. We are no longer in a populist area, which is ridiculous, because now, into 8 years later, we seem to be deep in a populist era. And you look at the Tea Party movement, you look at Occupy Wall Street, you look at Black Lives Matter. Those are three examples of populist movements.
Historians are terrible at predicting the future. That's something that we're not good at.
So, you know, I think about populism of today, and I think about social media. And so now you have people are empowered. Everyone has a voice. We, you know, we're doing this podcast. We're just
right.
We're two schmoes who like history, and we're doing a history history podcast. So that means anyone can do anything. Anyone can write a blog. Everybody's got Twitter. They all have Facebook. Everyone has a voice. How has that shaped these populist movements and groups that we see active today?
Right. Well, this is not one of my areas of academic expertise, but I've been following this and I've been very interested in it. And I think what you get with social media, with Facebook, with Twitter, and things like this, is and even with the news networks that, you know, like Fox News or MSNBC, that kind of start with an answer before they've looked at the evidence. You know, one of the problems you get is that, you know, people can create the facade that they are fully informed. But the things that they experience, Facebook has positive feedback cycles built into it. So it doesn't want to tell you things you don't like. It figures out what your politics are. And then it tells you things that'll keep you on there. Twitter, you can, it's not like, you know, your friends, you have to follow each other to, you know, have to friend each other. You can choose who to follow, which means your Twitter feed looks like it's coming from all over the world, and it is, but you've shaped it to tell you what you wanted to tell you. So I think what it does is it creates, you know, it does give us information, and a lot of information, but it creates a world in which we can self-select what we see, yet still have the facade that we're seeing everything. And I think that can lead to polarization unless we're careful and do things like, you know, find balanced sources and listen to things like this podcast, which doesn't have does not come in with a built-in agenda, simply to understand the past and work to get a full picture. Most people have something to offer. Right, as I ask at the end of my U.S. History 2 class, you know, when we get into the 21st century, I say, last day, I say, does anybody here found that one party has had all the good ideas or all the bad ideas? And they say no, and I'm like, okay, well, no party has a monopoly on bad ideas. So you should be willing to listen to both sides. Sometimes you'll find that, you know, the person that everyone's told you is a bad guy, not quite so.
So we have these two parties in this country, and they both have been jolted internally by populist movements. You know, you have the far left or the left populist movement that you would think of the Bernie Sanders of
right.
this 2016 cycle. And you have the right, which has been co-opted by Donald Trump.
Right.
And neither of these individuals' movements fit into the ideological categories of the parties that they're co-opting
right.
in a lot of ways. So if we live in a society where we get the media we want, how are we going to come together as a nation and come up with those good ideas and agree? Because it seems like the gulf between the right and the left has never been wider.
Yeah, well, sometimes it feels that way. I think, and maybe this is a cop-out. Maybe it is, but I think it's up to ourselves to take that step and find the opportunities there are to find middle ground. If we live immersed in a world that maybe it's comfortable. And sure, it's comfortable. If you're constantly looking at sources that seem smart, that are telling you that you're right, you're patting yourself on the back, that feels good. But, civic responsibility is not supposed to be, opium. We have to be willing to go out of our zone and our comfort zones, and we have to be willing to engage information that we might not like, but process it. And as I've told my students, a story that my good friend John Sullivan told me, a guy he's in the Navy with, once told him that he thought the problem with the world was that, people used to bring their ideas to the table and set them down on the table. So when the ideas were attacked, people could figure out whether or not the idea was good or bad. If it was good, you picked it up and walked away. If it was bad, you left it on the table. But now the idea stays on your chest. And so when you attack the idea, people get the sense that you're attacking them. And so I think it's important for us to detach these ideologies, these logos we put on ourselves. Put them on the table. If they're good, you'll pick them up. They'll be stronger. If they're bad, then you walk away from them and you're stronger. Realizing you're wrong, it does not have to be a blow to your ego. It can be an incredibly empowering opportunity to get right.
Well, that seems like an adult way to think of it. But but in our politics of today, it seems like the politician who compromises or the politician who reaches out to someone who doesn't agree with them ideologically gets punished by their own party. And it seems like the politics of personal attack are, that's standard. And let me say, the politics of personal attack aren't a 20th century or 21st century invention. I mean, if you go back and look at the politics of the 1840s and 1850s, you see some really terrible, terrible things like canings on the floor of the Senate.
Oh, yeah.
And even the
Preston Brooks.
Yeah, and even if you look at the 1824 and 1828 elections with Andrew Jackson, which was maybe one of the first real populist movements in our history, just terrible, terrible people calling each other.
Thomas Jefferson once called John Adams a hideous hermaphroditical character with neither the force and firmness of a man nor the gentleness and kindness of a woman.
That's a nice one to have on the tip of your tongue. Well, so what have we got to wrap it up now. What have we learned today?
I think we've set the groundwork for and hopefully introduced everyone who's listening to what we're going to try to do. Our goal is not to have an agenda. Our goal is to discuss. Our goal is to put our minds in and to be the hopefully the people who start with a question in the world. And we have the opportunity to bring some really smart people to the table. And I hope this conversation of populism, without any spiraling into political or ad hominem attacks. Demonstrates to folks, one, that we're thoughtful, that we're looking for input. We hope you'll send us any input you have on this and thoughts you have, and that you can know that our goal is to actually discuss these issues and bring the history of unique individuals and brilliant individuals into dialogue with history in a way that hopefully everyone can appreciate. And if you don't, let us know.
Well, thanks for joining us today on The Road to Now. You can follow us on Twitter @road_2_now. Or if you have any comments or questions, feel free to email us at roadtonowcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay safe. We'll see you soon. Thanks.